Credence was given to the rumour by the fact that the same telegraph message authorised the grant of 6,000 acres of land to Kami Mission. Mr. Rhodes was squaring the God-botherers, and the volunteers were not going to stand for it. 50 troopers, all full of whisky, rode out to burn down the mission and string up the hag responsible for their loss. Zuga Ballantyne and Mungo St. John met them at the foot of the hills. With a few salty sallies, they had them laughing. Then they took it in turn to curse them fluently and roundly, and finally they drove them back to town, where they stood them a dozen rounds of drinks. Despite the redistribution to the tribe, still the flood of cattle upon the market brought the price down to £2 a head, and Zuga used half the proceeds of the Ballantyne diamond to buy up 10,000 of them to stock his new estates. Now, as Zuga and Louise rode together, with Jan Sharoot following them in the Scotch cart, with the tent and camping equipment, they passed small herds of the cattle tended by Matabele herders that Zuga had hired. Zuga had been able to select only the best animals, and he had graded them by colour, so that one herd might consist of all red beasts, while the next of only black ones. Ralph had contracted to bring up all the materials for the new homestead from the railhead at Kimberley, and with the same convoy would be 20 thoroughbred bulls of Hereford stock that Zuga intended running with his cows. "This is the place," Louise exclaimed with delight. "How can you be so certain, so soon?" Zuga laughed. "Oh, darling, it's perfect. I can spend the rest of my life looking at that view." Below them the land fell away steeply to deep green pools of the river. "At least there will be good water, and the bottom land will grow excellent vegetables." "Oh, don't be so unromantic," she chided him. "Look at the trees." They soared above their heads like the arched and vaulted spans of a great cathedral, and the autumn foliage was a thousand shades of reds and golds, murmurous with bees and merry with birdsong. "They will give good shade in the hot season," Zuga agreed. "Shame on you," she laughed. "If you cannot see their beauty, then look at the Tavis in Dunas." The hills of the Indunas were whale-backed and dreaming blue beneath the tall silver clouds. The grassy plains between were scattered with small groups of Zuga's cattle and of wild game, zebra and blue wildebeest. "They are close enough," Zuga nodded. "When Ralph's construction company finally reaches Gubuluwayo with the railway line, then we shall be a few hours' ride from the railhead and all the amenities of civilization."
"So you will build me a home here on this very spot?"
"Not until you give it a name."
"What would you like to call it, my darling husband?"
"I'd like it to have a touch of the old country. King's Lynn was where I spent my childhood."
"Well, that's it, then." "King's Lynn," Zuga tested the name. "Yes, that will do very nicely. Now you shall have the home you want."
Louise took his hand, and they walked down under the trees towards the river. A man and a woman came down the narrow winding pathway through the thick riverine bush. The man carried his shield on his left shoulder, with the broad-bladed assegai secured to it by the rawhide thongs. But his right arm was shortened and deformed, twisted out from his shoulder as though the bone had been broken and badly set. There was no superfluous flesh upon his powerfully boned frame. The rack of his ribs showed through, and his skin lacked the lustre of health. It was the dull, lifeless colour of lamp black, as though he had just risen from a long sickbed. On his trunk and back gleamed the satiny rosettes of freshly healed gunshot wounds, like newly minted coins of pure blue cobalt. The woman who followed him was young and straight. Her eyes were slanted and her features those of an Egyptian princess. Her breasts were fat and full with milk, and her infant son was strapped tightly to her back so that his head would not jerk or wobble to her long swinging gait. Butso reached the bank of the river and turned to his wife. "We will rest here, Tanazi." She loosened the knot and swung the child onto her hip. She took one of her swollen nipples between thumb and forefinger until milk spurted from it, and then she touched it to the boy's lips. Immediately he began to feed with little pig-like snuffles and grunts.
When will we reach the next village? She asked. When the sun is there, Butso pointed halfway down the sky. Are you not weary of the road? We have travelled so far, so long. I will never weary. Not until we have delivered the word to every man and woman and child in Matabili land, she replied. And she began to joggle the baby and croon to it. Tungata is your name, for you will be a seeker. Zebiwe is your name, for what you will seek is that which has been stolen from you and your people. Drink my words, Tungata Zebiwe. Even as you drink my milk, remember them all your days, Tungata, and teach them to your own children. Remember the wounds on your father's breast and the wounds in your mother's heart, and teach your children to hate. She changed the infant to her other hip and her other breast, and she went on crooning until he had drunk his fill and his little head drooped sleepily. Then she slung him upon her back once more, and they crossed the river and went on. They reached the village an hour before the setting of the sun. There were less than 100 people living in the scattered huts. They saw the young couple from afar, and a dozen of the men came out to greet them with respect and lead them in. The women brought them grilled maize cakes and thick soured milk in calabash gourds, and the children came to stare at the strangers and to whisper to one another. These are the wanderers. These are the people from the hills of the Matopos. When they had eaten, and the sun had set, the villagers built up the fire. Tanasi stood in the firelight, and they squatted in a circle about her, silent and intent. I am called Tanasi, she said, and once I was the Amlimo. There was a low gasp of shock at her mention of that name. I was the Amlimo, Tanasi repeated, but then the powers of the spirits were taken from me. They sighed softly and stirred like dead leaves when a random breeze passes. There is another who is now the Amlimo, and lives in the secret place in the hills, for the Amlimo never dies. There was a little hum of assent. Now I am the voice of the Amlimo only. I am the messenger who brings you the word of the Amlimo. Listen well, my children, for the Amlimo prophesies thus. She paused, and now the silence was charged with religious terror. When the noon sun goes dark with wings, and the trees are bare of leaves in the springtime, then the warriors of Matabili put an edge to your steel. Tanasi paused, and the firelight gleamed on the hundreds of eyes that watched her. When the cattle lie with their heads twisted to touch their flank and cannot rise, then will be the time to rise up and to strike with the steel. She spread her arms like a crucifix and cried out, That is the prophecy. Hearken to it, children of Mashobani. Hearken to the voice of the Amlimo, for the Matabili will be great once again. In the dawn, the two wanderers, carrying the infant who was named the Seeker after what has been stolen, went on towards the next village, where the elders came out to greet them. In the southern springtime of 1896, on the shores of a lake near the southern extremity of the Rift Valley, that mighty geological fault which splits the African continental shield like an axe stroke, a bizarre hatching occurred. The huge egg masses of Cystocerca gregaria, the desert locust, that were buried in the loose earth along the border of the lake, released countless multitudes of flightless nymphs. The eggs had been laid by females in the solitary phase of the locust's life cycle. But so vast was the hatching of their progeny that the earth could not contain them, and though they spread out over an area of almost 50 square miles, they were forced to crawl upon one another's backs. The constant agitation and stimulation of contact with other nymphs wrought a miraculous change in this teeming tide of insects. Their colour turned to a vivid orange and midnight black, unlike their parents' drab brown. Their metabolic rate surged, and they became hyperactive and nervous. Their legs grew longer and stronger,
their gregarious instincts more powerful, so that they flowed in a compact body that seemed to be a single monstrous organism. They had entered the gregarious phase of the life cycle, and when at last they molted for the last time, and their newly fledged wings had dried, the entire swarm took spontaneously to the air. In that first baptism of flight, they were spurred by their high body temperature, which was raised further by their muscular activity. They could not stop until the cool of evening, and then they settled in such dense swarms that the branches of the forest snapped under their weight. They fed voraciously all night, and in the morning, the rising heat spurred them into flight once more. They rose in a cloud so dense that the sound of their wings was the drumming roar of hurricane winds. The trees they left behind were stripped completely of their tender springtime foliage. As they passed overhead, their wings eclipsed the noonday sun, and a deep shadow fell over the land. They were headed south, towards the Zambezi River. From the Great Sud, where the infant Nile River weaves its way through fathomless swamps of floating papyrus, southwards over the wide savannas of eastern and central Africa, down to the Zambezi and beyond, roamed vast herds of buffalo. They had never been hunted by the primitive tribes, who preferred easier game. Only a few Europeans with sophisticated weapons had ventured into these remote lands, and even the lions which followed the herds could not check their natural multiplication. The grasslands were black with the huge bovine black beasts. 20 or 30,000 strong, the herds were so dense that the animals in the rear literally starved, for the pasture was destroyed before they could reach it. Weakened by their own vast multitudes, they were ripe for the pestilence that came out of the north. It was the same plague that Moses' God had inflicted on the Pharaoh of Egypt, the Rinderpest, the Peste Bovina, a virus disease which attacks cattle and all other ruminants. The stricken animals were blinded by the discharge of thick mucus from their eyes. It poured in ropes from their gaping jaws and nostrils to contaminate the pastures and infect any other animal that passed over them. Their emaciated bodies were racked by spasms of profuse diarrhea and dysentery. And when at last they dropped, the convulsions twisted their heads back upon their tortured necks so that their noses touched one of their flanks, and they could never rise again. So swift was the passage of the disease that a herd of 10,000 great horned black beasts was wiped out between dawn and sunset. Their carcasses lay so thickly that they touched each other, and the characteristic fetid odour of the disease mingled with the stench of rotting flesh. For although the vultures gorged, they could not devour 1,000th part of this dreadful harvest of death. Swiftly, carried by the vultures and the blundering, bellowing herds, the plague swept southwards towards the Zambezi River. On the banks of that mighty river, Tanasi stood beside another watchfire and repeated the prophecy of the Amlimo. When the noon sun goes dark with wings, and the trees are bare of leaves in the springtime, when the cattle lie with their heads twisted to touch their flank, and cannot rise. Thus, she cried. And the people of the Matabili listened, and took new heart, and looked to their steel.